Today, the President of the United States has flown from the nation's capital to Detroit, Michigan, to deliver a major speech as the climax of the Motor City's 250th birthday anniversary. In the year 1701, Antoine Cadillac, French nobleman and explorer with a royal charter from France's Louis XIV, established here a military and trading post. The first fort was built on the banks of the Detroit River, just a few blocks from the scene of this address, City Hall Steps in Cadillac Square. From this handful of settlers, the city grew under French, British, and finally American rule to a metropolis of 1.75 million people and one of the leading industrial centers of the nation. Some 50,000 people have gathered here to hear the president's address today, in which he is expected to discuss the National Defense Mobilization Program. In just a moment, Mr. Truman will appear at the speaker stand and will be greeted by the traditional musical honors, ruffles, and flourishes, and hail to the chief. The president will be introduced by his honor, the mayor of Detroit, Albert E. Cobo.
Mr. President, ladies and gentlemen, I am privileged to welcome you here today to the celebration of our 250th birthday. We Detroiters are greatly honored on this occasion. I am especially proud today to present the President of the United States.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor, very much. Mr. Mayor, Governor, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, I'm happy to come to this great city of Detroit and to join with you in celebrating its 250th birthday. I do not suppose that Cadillac and his little band of French pioneers would blink their eyes if they could see what has happened on the spot where they built this fort back in 1701. To them, the word Detroit meant a narrow place in the river. In George Washington's time, it meant a place of danger, a source of Indian raids and scalping parties. Today, the word Detroit is a synonym throughout the world for the industrial greatness of America. Today, the word Detroit symbolizes for free men everywhere the productive power, which is a foundation stone in world peace. In the last war, Detroit proved itself as one of the great production centers of the arsenal of democracy. Its tanks and trucks rumbled ashore on every beachhead from Normandy to Okinawa. From Detroit and other great American cities came such an outpouring of the weapons and equipment of war as had never been seen before in all history. That miracle of production was made possible by American industry in action. It was made possible by the expert management and skilled workers of America. Free men working together here in Detroit made it possible for free men around the world to win the war. Today, once again, the productive power of Detroit is bringing hope and courage to brave people throughout the world who are determined to defend themselves against aggression. Today, again, the success or failure of the cause of freedom depends on what is done here in your great factories and assembly plants. The free world is counting on you to build airplanes and tanks and army trucks and weapons. billions of dollars worth of defense orders have been placed in the Detroit area. Production on some of these orders has already begun, and on others it will soon be starting. Military equipment will flow from Detroit factories in a growing stream. I know that this means changes for many of you. Thousands of workers in Detroit have already shifted from non-defense to defense jobs, and thousands of others will have to shift to defense jobs. Still others are affected by the cutbacks in civilian production, which are necessary to make steel and other scarce materials available for military use. But employment in Detroit is higher now than it was even at the peak of World War II. Think of that. Employment in Detroit is higher now than it was even at the peak of World War II. But these cutbacks have resulted in some temporary unemployment. Military needs have forced a reduction in metals available for making passenger cars. This means that men have been laid off, and some of them have not yet found other work. This is a temporary situation. It's the kind of thing that has always happened in the early part of a big conversion operation. But it's important to keep unemployment and other conversion difficulties to a minimum. I have directed the defense agencies to review the situation here thoroughly. I told them to be sure that everything possible is done to make the conversion process work smoothly. I don't propose to let the working men of Detroit suffer any unemployment that can be avoided. I don't propose to let their know-how, which is one of our greatest national assets, be wasted by unemployment in the middle of this immense defense program. In working on this problem, the defense agencies have been getting a lot of help from some of your able union leaders who've been making very constructive suggestions. Detroit manufacturers have also offered some first-class ideas. I want to assure you that Charlie Wilson and the Department of Defense and the other defense agencies are just as concerned about this problem as you are and are doing their best to solve it. One reason I'm sure they're going to keep on their best is because of your new senator, Blair Moody. That fellow's a go-getter. He bothers nearly everybody in Washington to death trying to get things for Detroit. This problem of conversion unemployment will be with us for some months, but we'll do all we can to keep it down while defense production is taking up the slack. Our defense program is going to roll ahead bigger and bigger as we move toward our goals of national security and world peace. This past year has been a period of challenge. It has tested all we have done since the end of World War II to bring about peace in the world. Aggression in Korea was aimed at the whole idea of the United Nations. It was the purpose of the aggressors to pick off one free nation after another. They intended to create fear in the hearts of the free peoples and to force them to submit to communist domination and control. We could have given up in face of that attack. We could have abandoned the United Nations and torn up the charter. We could have retreated into a hopeless and fearful isolationism, just as we did after the First World War. But this time we didn't do that. This time we went forward. With our allies, we met the challenge. And today, the United Nations is a going concern, stronger than ever. Today, the Charter means more than it ever did. It has been tested by fire and sword. Today, it offers real protection to the free nations of the world. The free nations have made their determination clear. We will not give in to aggression. Our plans for world peace still stand. We will never quit in the fight for world peace. The communists have asked for talks looking toward a settlement of the Korean conflict. Those talks are in progress. We do not yet know whether the communists really desire peace in Korea or whether they are simply trying to gain by negotiations what they have not been able to gain by conquest. We intend to find that out. The talks can be successful if the communists are, in fact, ready to give up aggression in Korea. But whatever happens in Korea, we must not make the mistake of jumping to the conclusion that the Soviet rulers have given up their ideas of world conquest. They may talk about peace, but it is action that counts. What they have been doing is quite clear. They are putting themselves in a position where they can commit new acts of aggression at any time. Well, right now, for example, the armed forces of the Soviet satellites are rapidly being brought to a peak of military readiness. In the last several months, the satellite countries in Eastern Europe have been forced by the Kremlin to reorganize their armies. The size of these armies has been increased, and modern Russian equipment is being furnished to them in large quantities. We know that Bulgaria, Romania, and Hungary now have armed forces far greater than those allowed under the peace treaties they signed in 1947. That's one of our difficulties in dealing with Soviets of any kind. They have no respect for signed treaties or their given word. We know also that Romania recently ordered the inhabitants moved out of a stretch of land 30 miles wide along the Yugoslav border. Bulgaria and Hungary have done the same thing. Military preparations have been going on in those zones along the border. Actions like these are certainly no indication of peaceful intent. In the Far East, the situation is much the same. The North Koreans and the Chinese communists, so-called volunteers, are getting a steady flow of new equipment from the Soviet Union for ground and air use. The Russians themselves have more than 4 million men under arms in Europe and the Far East. There are heavy concentrations of Soviet air, land, and sea forces in the Russian provinces along the Manchurian border, across from Japan, and across from Alaska. As your president, I am telling you that the dangers in other parts of the world are just as great as they are in Korea. Every day, reports come to my desk about Soviet military preparations around the world. If every one of you could see these reports and receive this same information, you would give up any thought that danger is over. You would be just as anxious as I am to see that this country builds up its armed forces, equips them with the most modern weapons, and helps to arm our allies. Don't let anyone confuse you about this. We cannot let down our guard no matter what happens in Korea. The free world must have armed strength. The free world must have it now. Not in reserve, not later, but now. We must have men, ships, planes, tanks, and bombs on hand, ready for any emergency. And if we have them, we won't have to use them. We hope and believe that we will not have to use the armed strength we're building up. Our aim is to put an end to war. But we know that unless we have armed strength, we cannot put out the fires of aggression that threaten the peace of the world at this time. The aim of this administration is world peace. My term in office is dedicated to bringing us closer to that goal. Our great chance lies in building up such strength and unity among the free nations that the Kremlin will have to drop its plans of aggression and subversion. When we reach that point, there can be peace between the Soviet Union and the rest of the world. They can have peace any time they want it. I know of only two alternatives to this policy, and the American people have rejected both of them. One is to start a world war now, with all its horrible and unforeseeable consequences. Some people would like to do that. The other is to withdraw and isolate ourselves. That means surrendering the rest of the world to Soviet communism.